We've read your briefs and we've read your record excerpts, and we're familiar with your arguments, so I think you know, if you get the yellow light, you've got 2 minutes, you get the red light, please finish your sentence. Thank you very much. All right, we call the first case, United States versus Taze.
Good morning. Ray Hayes was convicted of one count of bank fraud and four counts of bankruptcy fraud.
You might want to state your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Judge. My name's A.M. Stroud III. I'm from Shreveport, and I'm appearing here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Ray Hayes. He was convicted on five counts, given 30 months on each count to run consecutively, and was ordered to pay restitution in the amount of $158,454. His appeal is grounded in his due process right to present a defense to the charges against him. Specifically, we contend that the district court erred in its exclusion of evidence by denying him the ability fully to develop and present the defense of lack of specific intent, and indeed, that's the only defense in this case. The facts are clear. Our defense went to the mental element, both bank fraud and bankruptcy fraud carry the element of specific intent.
Mr. Stroud, at times in your brief, you couch this as if you're making some sort of constitutional argument, but you agree, don't you, that this case would be reviewed under Federal Rule of Evidence 103, whether the judge abused his discretion in not admitting this evidence?
Yes, sir.
That's the standard of review.
The standard of review is whether the judge abused his discretion and whether the defendant can show that the exclusion of evidence prejudiced him. I agree, Judge. That is the appropriate standard of review. In this particular case, Mr. Hayes was a small businessman. He had Fire Security Systems, Inc. It was a small fire sprinkler company. He'd been working in the Shreveport area for about 30 years. He began doing business with First Louisiana Bank in Shreveport. The individual he dealt with was Tom Glass, who was a vice president.
Let me ask you about Mr. Glass. When this demand letter was excluded by the court, didn't your client tell the judge that he was going to call Mr. Glass as a witness to testify to the content of the letter? But he didn't call him. I'm curious.
As I understand, the judge said, well, you can call him later, but as I understood, going back over the record, and we had three proffers, he said we could call Mr. Glass, but that we could not, as my understanding, we could not use the letter. And the judge was specific on several occasions when he told me, Mr. Stroud, your client, if he wants to, can take the stand and testify. You can call witnesses, but you're not going to get into the letters. That's too far afield. In fact, there was one exhibit.
Government. Not going to get into the physical introduction of the letter as an exhibit, or that he could not ask Mr. Glass about the contents of the letter?
It's my understanding, Judge, from his ruling, that we could not get into the contents of the letter. I tried every which way I knew to try to get the exhibit in, but when the trial court said no, I moved on and attempted to try to preserve the record. I was concerned because it's either in Government's Exhibit 31 or 32, there were a list of all the jobs that Mr. Hayes had. And on the right-hand corner, there was a check mark as to whether or not there were bonded jobs or not. The government introduced the exhibit to try to show, to talk about the Walmart project. When that exhibit was introduced, At a sidebar, I believe, I asked the judge, they've introduced the exhibit. There are these other projects on there. Can I go into what about these other projects? And he said, Mr. Stroud, you cannot go in any
non-Walmart.
Yes, ma'am. So I didn't go into it there. The exhibit was in, but I could not go into that particular exhibit. And I concede, and I think I would be less than candid with the court, I concede that the evidence was sufficient for a reasonably minded jury to find Mr. Hayes guilty. My problem is that I think it's the fact that we were excluded from producing any evidence to corroborate the statements of Mr. Hayes severely prejudiced us in the jury's evaluation of the case. This goes to the sentencing equation.
Corroborate what statements?
Corroborate Mr. Hayes' statement that non-bonded jobs could not be pledged, but bonded jobs could. And the interesting
along that line, as I understand it, defendant's work had been completed before he applied for the loan. He had not received his retainage, but his work was completed. Is that actually correct?
His work, for all practical purposes, yes, sir, had been completed.
All right. So why is a bond even relevant?
Because, Judge, on this particular case, if a bonded job could not serve as security, the bank was not entitled to that money.
But again, the bond was to ensure performance, I assume, and his performance was complete.
His performance was complete, but as he testified at trial, he had, and basically, Judge, just to back up a minute, he stepped into the shoes of Miller. Miller had left, abandoned the job, vacated it for whatever reason. He was left to finish the job, and he was dealing with Walmart. When the job was completed, his contention was, as he testified at trial, that he was owed approximately $320,000. He believed that the final settlement amount, which was $154,000, which represented approximately 50% of the claim, it did coincide with the amount lent for the retainage. But his argument was there were other things that took place, that he had to finish the job for Miller, and when he finished the job for Miller, he was looking for payment for $320,000. And he got that money, and then when he got the money, he attempted to use it through the factoring of the money through Mr. Hollingshead. Now, given the strictures that we were in, and given the fact that the only thing I could do was ask my client, basically, can you pledge bonded jobs? His answer was no. His CPA, if you can see that in another.
Wouldn't that be, that's almost tantamount to fraud there. He went to the bank, he said, lend me money against this retainage, yet he knew it was bonded, and now he's claiming you can't lend money against a bonded project, yet that's what he asked the bank to do.
Judge, in his mind, this was part of the $320,000 that Walmart owed him. The bank, there were two things that secured the agreement. One was a tripartite agreement, which basically was an agreement between Miller, First Louisiana Bank, and Mr. Hayes, that any check issued by Miller would have the co-payees would be Mr. Hayes and First Louisiana Bank. Miller never issued a check one under that agreement. Miller left, so now that leaves Mr. Hayes there with a contract, part of a contract, with the other party gone. He then turned his focus upon Walmart, who was the owner of the project. And that's where he was geared. He was his focus towards Walmart. The argument that you make, excuse me, Judge, not the argument, the proposition that you made was certainly a reasonable one based on the part of the evidence that we got in. My position, and has been from the first, and I have not been successful with anybody yet in this case, and maybe I'm looking at it wrong, but looking at it time and time and time again, there is this big distinction between bonded and non-bonded jobs. And I'll give you for instance, in one of the proffers defense exhibits proffer, it's in record excerpt 6. The letter that we had a complaint about was the letter that Tom Glass dated September 26, 2002, and it's sent to the General Services Administration, to whom it may concern, asserting a lien on those projects. On the second page of that document, it says on number six that it covers every all inventory, accounts receivable, parens, except any accounts encumbered by bonding company, close parens. Mr. Hayes testified, I believe, that once these letters went out to all his projects, and again, if you go back and look, I believe, at Government Exhibit 31 or 32, there were a lot of projects. The letters went to these projects, and Mr. Hayes was effectively shut down. He had no money coming in. He was the one that was asked to complete the Walmart job. His attorney went in and attempted to negotiate a payment on the Walmart job. That negotiation occurred in 2003. And there's correspondence about that. And in 2003, when Mr. Hayes got that money of $154,000 and change, he immediately went to Mr. Hollinshead and deposited the money with him in order to receive money, in order that he could try to continue his business and to fund the successor business. When the court excluded our evidence, including documents like that, I think, quite frankly, that Mr. Hayes' words rang hollow.
Was it explained to the trial court why you thought these were key pieces of evidence to your defense?
Yes, sir, I did, and it's contained in exhibit. There were three proffers. It was contained in proffer six, and going back and reading it in the heat of battle, I don't want to call it battle, but a heat of discussion and argument with the judge, perhaps I could have been more clearer. But I talked from day one about these other evidence and this letter to General Services Administration was one of about 20 letters we had, but I didn't want to clutter up the record, and I think I made it clear that this was just a representative copy. But when these letters hit, Mr. Hayes had absolutely nothing he could do in order to make the payment. The property was foreclosed. Everything was seized. Everything was sold. He then files bankruptcy, and during the bankruptcy proceeding in 2004, he's asked about this money, and he talks about the money, and he says, yeah, I got the money, and that comes up, so he's charged with bankruptcy fraud. But the interesting part about that, to me, about one of the interesting parts about the deposition, and I think I mentioned it in my initial brief, the attorney for the bank was going through things with Mr. Hayes, and he starts talking about the various projects, and then he makes an interesting comment, I think at page 92, oh, this is a bonded job. The bank didn't have a lien on that. So here's a representative of the bank making the statement in a deposition, which is inconsistent, I believe, with the position Mr. Glass took in his dealings with Mr. Hayes. And again, this was the essence of the disagreement between the parties.
Judge Hicks. Was that deposition brought to the attention of the trial, of the jury?
That deposition was brought.
Bankruptcy court, wherever you wanted to use it.
It was introduced by the government. The government introduced to show that there were statements in there that they claimed were incorrect. And again, this was another part of the deposition, and maybe I didn't make myself clear, but I was firmly, when a judge tells you don't do anything else except through your man, I wasn't going to go close to that. Because
you didn't introduce that portion of the deposition into evidence.
That deposition was introduced by the government.
The whole deposition?
I believe it was.
But you know, it sounds like while you might have had a interesting civil action, we're here on a criminal charge that you concede the jury probably had enough evidence to convict.
I do concede that, Judge, and I couldn't stand up here and say anything to the contrary. My problem is we were not allowed to present our evidence in a light sufficient for the jury properly to evaluate the conclusion. If the jury, if we had gotten this evidence in and the jury convicted my client, then we would not be here today.
Well, I really don't see how you can claim that not getting that evidence in justified bankruptcy fraud, where he denied income, he denied this, that, and the other, and you're now saying his only reason for denying it was because he was so distraught over losing his company. That's not a defense in a criminal action.
But I agree with that as a general proposition. But Judge, if for example, he said in his answer to one, "Have you had any income in the last 3 years?" He puts no. Three pages earlier, he lists all his income. To me, he's either a very dumb criminal, or he is severely emotionally wrecked over this case. And I think if I'd gotten another evidence in, I would have been able to argue that to the jury. The judge excluded it. And I think it was a reasonable defense. I think that we should have been allowed to present this defense. The judge disallowed it. And I put it like this. It's.
You have time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Josette Cassier, representing the government in this case. This is the devil made me do it defense, and the devil is the bank right here. And defendant presented as his defense that he did not intend to defraud the bank, he never had that intent, and that his understanding was that bonded jobs could not be pledged to secure the loan. Yet, as Judge Barksdale pointed out, he went to the bank expressly saying he wanted to borrow money against the retainage on a completed job that was, the bonding was no longer relevant to it at all. He had filed an application for the retainage in December of 2001, approximately a month and a half before he actually completed the loan documents. He applied for a loan, and that is Exhibit 1, the loan application. And the bank officer stated that the security will be, and let me just read it exactly, the total of the 10% retainage will not be paid until the general contractor files for the entire retainage. The general contractor will agree to make the check payable to fire security and the bank. States Fire Security Systems has completed a subcontract. In the actual contract, the security agreement that was executed, defendant signed it, and he pledged the contract itself with Miller, and it is labeled as Exhibit A, and it is in the attached to the exhibits, to the loan exhibits. And in there is Article 23, which says that the defendant, the subcontractor, could not assign the proceeds of the contract, nor could he subcontract out the work that was to be done under the contract without prior approval. The tri-party agreement that is discussed so much through the trial in these documents was a means of getting the contractor, Miller, to approve the assignment of the proceeds, the retainage proceeds, which were the only thing left to be paid, to First Louisiana Bank, FLB, the lender. Defendant knew that that's what this was about. It was to get the contractor to agree that these funds could be assigned to the bank. Defendant expressly went to the bank to get a loan because the retainage had not been paid and he was in a crunch and could no longer use his line of credit at the bank. So he knew what he was doing at the time.
When did Miller, the entity Miller, supposedly walk off the job in relationship to when he obtained his loan from the bank?
He obtained his loan from the bank in February of 2002. The testimony at trial is that Miller left sometime in very late spring or early summer of 2002. That would mean sometime May, June. But there is no direct testimony regarding exactly when Miller walked off the job. However, defendant, when he applied for the retainage in December of 2001, before he got the loan, he applied for it on a Walmart form C-1200. So he was dealing with Walmart, apparently, at that time, before he ever went to get his loan. At least that is what is there. The timeline is important. Defendant apparently believed that this job could be assigned because he did assign it. He assigned the proceeds from this job. So he believed that it could be assigned through the initial loan documents, the two extensions and renewals of the loan, and even after the bank made demand on him, stating that he was in default on the loan, he sent a letter within the 10 days that the bank had given him, and that is exhibit, I don't have that exhibit number, but he did send a letter, I believe it's 45. He sent a letter to the bank stating that he was, a copy of a letter that he had gotten from his lawyer in Florida who was negotiating with Walmart for a settlement, and he acknowledges in there that the retainage of $154,000, whatever odd figure it was, is pledged at the bank, and he wanted to have the settlement in at least that amount so that he could wash away his troubles with the bank or something to that effect. But he did acknowledge it. The point at which defendant suddenly starts not believing that this bonded project could be pledged or assigned, or that he had not actually assigned it, is after the bank began making demand on other loans and other collateral. That is irrelevant to what he did with this collateral securing this particular loan, which is the only one the government charged as bank fraud. And the district judge heard extensive argument on this, and defense counsel made proffer of these demand letters. They are irrelevant to what defendant actually did. And his defense of the bank made me do this because they made demand, they dried up my money, is no defense to the surreptitious manner in which he went about hiding these funds. And he did do that, and the testimony at trial is exhaustive about how he received the money, put it, it was payable only to him, and then it was run through Hollinshead's Team Spirit Petroleum account. He used official checks from the bank, never went through his accounts, hoping not that it would not be traceable. And it's obvious that that is what his purpose was.
Were any of these demand letters specific to this transaction?
There was one demand letter that was introduced at trial, and that is the demand letter on this particular case. Loan. That is correct, Your Honor.
That was admitted.
The other
demand letters he wanted in were other transactions with other companies.
Exactly. He wanted those admitted. Well, the judge found that it would have been confusing to the jury, the bonded versus non-bonded, because the government never got into that because defendant had assigned it. He had assigned away all the documents he needed. He had gotten Miller to approve it. The bonding company was out of the picture because the job was complete at that point. There may have been some few punch items left to be done, but it was essentially complete, and that's why he was able to ask for the retainage. He was just delayed in getting the retainage because of the complications with Miller. But none of these other things with the demand letters occurred until long after he had been renewed three times. Are there any further questions? I yield the balance of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Stroud, you have a few minutes.
I believe that Again, as I said before, the issue, and the judge does have discretion, but in this case, as I was going to say, it's a little more complicated. It's as if the judge said, we gave a notice of alibi, and the judge let the defendant testify, and then the defendant had evidence to corroborate that, and the judge excluded it as being irrelevant and taking it into different fields. That's a simple explanation, and this is a more complicated case. But and the arguments have been that all this evidence is irrelevant, would confuse the jury, would lead us far afield. With all due respect, I believe that the evidence was directly on point. It dealt with the specific, and it tried to present an explanation for actions that at first glance appear to be illegal. And I believe when a jury is evaluating what a defendant does, the jury has a right to try to step in an individual's shoes and see what was going on with that individual. This man, there's something to be said about a 20-year, 25-year businessman who goes under like this and then takes desperate actions to try to save his company. Now, perhaps they were criminal. The jury so found. But when you have an individual with documents that the bank used that says these proceeds cannot be pledged, and the jury did not see that, I believe that severely infringed upon his right to a fair trial. And
you're talking about the letters. You're not talking, the bonds don't say that.
No, ma'am, it's the letters. But the UCC filings do say that. And the UCC filing that I introduced as it's part of the proffer number 6, the first page it talks about we're asserting a lien. Second page, it says the lien is not on any, do not cover any accounts receivable on a bonded job. So that was evidence that could have corroborated the testimony of Mr. Hayes for the jury to evaluate. With all due respect, I believe that evidence should have been admissible to allow the jury an appropriate universe from whence to determine the defendant's intent. Without that, I think we were severely crippled in our effort to present a defense. I conclude with what Judge Barksdale said at the beginning. The standard is deference to the trial court. The defendant has the burden of proving that he was prejudiced. We specifically believe that we've done that, and we would ask for appropriate relief.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Judge.